When a lawyer thinks a witness is lying, the attorney tries to back that person into a corner to trap the witness in his or her lie. There are times when the lying witness is finally trapped. We've all seen this play out on television, on everything from Perry Mason to Law and Order, and I'm told this moment is called a gotcha. A gotcha is that sweet moment for the attorney, an embarrassing moment for the witness when everybody in the courtroom knows the witness has not been telling the truth. Today's lectionary text relates the attempt of some enemies of Jesus to trap him in a gotcha. I'll hold off on reading the text for a short while because it won't make much sense unless I provide a little historical background. First, we need to understand the idea of levirate marriage. And second, we need to know something about a Jewish group called the Sadducees. The idea of levirate marriage arose in Jewish law because it was believed that a person lived on through his descendants. The Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, has almost no writings involving life after death. In fact, in the entire Old Testament, only the book of Daniel, which is one of the last books written that was included in the Hebrew Bible, has any mention of the idea of resurrection. I should mention that a couple of apocryphal books, The Wisdom of Solomon and 4th Maccabees, do mention the afterlife. Those books are included in the Catholic Bible and not in the Protestant Bible. Since it was believed a person survived death only by living on through his descendants, there was a great concern that a man who died before his wife bore children would be lost forever. I always bristle at this just a bit because it didn't matter if a woman left no descendants. In that highly patriarchal world, women just didn't matter all that much, and their primary function was to make sure they provided children, male children, for the men of the world. But in the first century, it was men that mattered, and for a man to have no children was considered a horrible fate. Eventually, he would not even be remembered. The practice of levirate marriage developed to remedy this situation and was written into Jewish law in the 25th chapter of Deuteronomy. I'll quote the passage. When a brother dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her, taking her in marriage, and performing the duty of a husband's brother to her, and the firstborn whom she bears shall succeed to the name of the deceased brother, so that his name will not be blotted out of Israel. Now make no mistake, they took this law seriously. In the euphemistic language of the Old Testament, pulling the sandal off someone's foot meant to disrobe him, pulling the sandal off his foot. Keep that in mind as you listen to how that passage from Deuteronomy continues. But if the man has no desire to marry his brother's widow, then his brother's widow shall go up to the elders at the gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband to me." Then the elders of the town shall summon him and speak to him. If he persists, saying, "I have no desire to marry her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, spit in his face, and declare, "This is what is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." In other words, if he refuses to attempt to impregnate her, she has the right to publicly yank his pants off and spit on him. The Old Testament is full of little nuggets like that if you know how to read it. Now that you have a grip on levirate marriage, let's examine the Sadducees. There were three major Jewish sects in first century Israel: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. The Pharisees get the harshest treatment in the New Testament because they are usually portrayed as the enemies of Jesus. The Pharisees were basically the mainline Jews. Their concern with ritual, purity, and proper observance of Jewish law placed them at odds with the message of Jesus, which said the kingdom of God includes everybody, even the outcasts. Remember, at that time, God was envisioned not as a God of compassion, but as a God of righteousness. So, human compassion took a backseat to human righteousness, human purity. There were countless religious laws based on remaining clean and pure. It was the view of Jesus that God's primary nature is love, and that God loves all people, the unclean as much as the clean. It was this belief that got him in so much trouble with the religious leaders of that time, who were mostly Pharisees. But the harsh treatment of the Pharisees by the New Testament writers is grounded mainly in the fact that the Pharisees were in control. The Essenes were a fringe group. These were the people who hid the Dead Sea Scrolls in the caves of Qumran. They were even more obsessed with purity than the Pharisees, and it is believed that the Essenes originally formed and left Jerusalem because they felt a man who lacked the proper credentials had become the chief priest, and that when he entered the Jerusalem temple, he made that most holy site in Israel impure. But the Pharisees and the Essenes shared at least one thing in common with Jesus. They believed in an afterlife. In fact, the Essenes were obsessed with the final coming battle between good and evil that would bring about the end of the world at any moment. The Sadducees, the third sect, did not believe in any form of afterlife. The Sadducees were the ultra-legalistic Jews. They were a small sect and had little influence among common people, but are thought to have been influential with a few very powerful and wealthy families. They accepted only the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, as scripture, rejecting all the writings that Jesus, the Pharisees, and the Essenes viewed as sacred and foundational to their faith. Now, with that background, let's look at today's lectionary text from the Gospel of Luke. This is Luke chapter 20, the Sadducees' attempt to back Jesus into a gotcha. Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and asked him a question. "Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless, then the second, and then the third married her, and so in the same way all seven married her and died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For all seven had married her." You can envision the wise old Sadducees snickering amongst themselves, thinking they had put this whippersnapper, Jesus, in his place. I've heard similar arguments that go like this. A father dies when he is 30 years old, and his son lives to be 100. In heaven, who's older, the father or the son? Gotcha. There must be no such thing as heaven and afterlife and resurrection, the reasoning goes, because it just doesn't make any sense. Here is the way Jesus answered the Sadducees' question. "Those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection." Okay. That's going to take a little unpacking, but let's not make it harder than it is. To me, what Jesus is saying here is this. Is there something beyond the grave? Yes. Is it like life here on earth? No. That's the message. There's more to our being than this life of flesh, but what lies beyond the grave is entirely different. There's no need for marriage, Jesus seems to say, because there's no need for children to be born. Death is no more. So repopulation is not a concern. I know men and women who are upset by this passage because they have faith that somehow they will see their departed loved ones beyond the grave. This passage should not take away that hope. It does not say people will not be recognizable. It says there will be no need for marriage, no need for reproduction. Later in the same passage from Luke's gospel, Jesus mentions historical figures from the Jewish past, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says that God is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, and that to God, all of them are alive. In our world today, the denial of the possibility of life beyond the grave has taken a bizarre turn. In the first century, it was the ultra-legalistic religious people, the Sadducees, who said that our being ends at the grave. Today, the ultra-legalistic religious people take just the opposite view. They not only claim that we are immortal, but they provide precise instructions on how to manipulate God into providing exactly the kind of afterlife you want. And today, it's a portion of the scientific community that claims the idea of any sort of afterlife is foolishness. Before I go any farther, let me state emphatically that I do not believe anybody has sure knowledge of what happens when we die, because the information is unavailable. And as a person of faith, I believe God designed the universe that way for a reason. I don't think we're meant to have sure knowledge of what lies beyond the grave. And that's where our faith comes in. And pretending we are absolutely certain about that which God has made sure we cannot know serves no purpose that I can see. But I will tell you, I am just as frustrated with those who claim that human existence absolutely, positively ends when our bodies cease to function, as I am with those who think they have a precision roadmap of the great beyond. We human beings are never quite as smart as we think we are. I remember reading how a little over 100 years ago, at the turn of the century in the year 1900, some scientists lamented that there was nothing left to invent. All the great inventions had already been invented, and now all we could do was improve on their designs. And of course, the 20th century saw more inventions than all of preceding history. Science, which I've often said is the best friend of humanity, is best when it remains humble. The driving force behind good science is a sense of wonder and awe at the magnificence of the universe. And there is, within that awe, a sense of humility at how much we do not know, and of how amazing it is that this little brain we've been given is capable of shaping the world into a sensible form. Okay, the next few moments are for those of you who, like me, love to read about science and are fascinated by science, but are far from having very scientific minds. At a lecture I recently attended at Wichita State University, one of the astronomy professors discussed the Big Bang. He dated it at 15.2 billion years ago and went through some of the physical processes that led up to the universe we have today. And then one of the students asked a question that a lot of people thought was pretty dumb. He said, "What was there before the Big Bang?" Of course, my natural thought was, well, God was there before the Big Bang. Now, I always tell people they need to think bigger when they think of God. We have this tendency to try to turn God into a human being like us. And even for those of us who are well past the idea of God being a bearded guy on the clouds who observes the world below, we still sometimes fall into that trap of making God look like us, or think like us, or act like us. What that professor said in answer to the question, what was there before the Big Bang forced me to allow my God to get even bigger. I can't phrase this exactly the way the professor did, so I'll put it in my own words. We see the world in four dimensions, the three dimensions of height and width and depth, and the fourth dimension of time, which allows stuff to move through that three-dimensional field. When we look at the universe, we see it in those four dimensions. When we study the Big Bang, we're looking at a thoroughly four-dimensional universe. Physicists have now concluded that there are many more than just four dimensions. Some have theorized nine, some have theorized 11 dimensions, and still others have theorized many more than that. This is that strange world of quantum physics and string theory that I love to read about and which I have no chance of ever really grasping. I confess, your poor minister has been stuck with a thoroughly four-dimensional brain. But that astronomy professor said that when we examine the Big Bang, we're looking at the beginning and the development of four dimensions. Is it possible that other dimensions were in existence prior to the Big Bang? Certainly, he said. Now, this proves absolutely nothing with regard to life beyond the grave. What it does tell us, however, is that science itself says there is much more to this world than what meets the eye. We human beings are granted only a narrow view of this amazing universe. It would be ridiculous for us to pretend we can form universal truths with a brain that was designed to see only a tiny fraction of reality. It was the Buddha, actually, who said for a human being to pretend he has knowledge of the eternal is like an unborn chick who has just begun to peck on the inside of a shell to pretend it knows all about the world. We just don't have the information. Like I said, this doesn't prove anything regarding the afterlife, but it should at least keep us humble enough to admit God has built possibilities into creation that we can only begin to imagine. Many people believe Plato was the greatest philosopher who ever lived, and Plato's best-known statement is one from which we can all still learn. After a lifetime of philosophical reflection, he said, "The only thing I know for sure is that I know nothing for sure." Well, it's thinking like that that can drive a guy to a life of faith. At least it has for me. As confusing as life is, I trust God. I think that it is in God that we live and move and have our being. And I believe that if we anchor our lives in God and not in ourselves, the possibilities become endless. I have no doubt that I am a time-bound, finite creature. There will come a time when people will walk this earth and laugh and cry and hurt and love, and I won't be here. But God is eternal. God is not bound within the constraints of time and space, and God's love is the very ground that holds me and everything else in this world in being. God is eternal. God's character is eternal. God's faithfulness is eternal. And God's love is eternal. There's no need spending time trying to figure out what happens after death, because Jesus told us it's there and it's different from what we're expecting. And there's certainly no need wasting energy worrying about what happens after death, because the matter is purely in God's hands where it belongs. We can't know what lies beyond this world, but our faith tells us that God's love is higher and deeper and wider than the furthest limits of our imaginations. And while God, thankfully, is in control of what lies on the other side of the grave, it's we who are given control of what happens on this side of the grave. And that's where our focus should be. Well, this has been a heavy sermon, but I really didn't have much choice, at least not if I was going to approach the text honestly. And that's the great thing about the lectionary, It forces us to confront Bible passages that we might otherwise skip over. It makes us think about the whole range of human life and religious ideas. Believe me, I don't think there's a minister in town who saw today's lectionary text and thought, "Whoa, I can't wait to preach on that." But it's good that we did. And in the final analysis, it seems to me that we can come away from today's text, one of the rare times Jesus talks about the afterlife, with some comfort. The answer just isn't that difficult. Love God, love creation. Always remember that, yes, we are our brother's keeper. And as we embrace this precious gift of human life, seek to be the vessels through which God's eternal love is poured upon this four-dimensional world God has placed in our care. That's the way we anchor ourselves on God's love, not by figuring out things no human being is meant to figure out, but by wholeheartedly turning ourselves over to love itself. Love is the better part of us. And while I would never claim to have knowledge of what lies beyond the grave, I do have a hunch. Something tells me that every part of a person that deserves to live forever will.